our last Bishulakum class. I'll take a little bit more time maybe than I would have otherwise to review for myself, just because it's been a little bit of a break, and then we'll move into hopefully these final very practical issues. Not as when I say practical, you'll see, especially the last one, practical in the sense of us as consumers, not so much as our own chefs or cooks, meaning we go to restaurants, etc., and there are issues that we should just be informed about. The last, you'll see the title of the shiur, Bishul Yisrael, part 3. The last three shiurim now that we are having are their own unit in the sense that the whole, we could really divide the learning. I believe this is the 12th shiur. I don't know if it falls out neatly, 4-4-4, not precisely, but it's really three units. The first unit, which we started with, was the actual prohibition of Bishul Akum. Where did it come from? Why did Chazal legislate it? Different theories and perhaps even practical differences between the theories. Those are the first few weeks, understanding all the potential problems, the chumrah, etc. Come on in. We're intimate tonight. The second group of classes which we had, which was for... if you want to swing around and share a sheet, I ran out of... I didn't make enough sheets. It's right there. So now it's not private anymore, sorry. The second group of classes that we had, which was a big bulk of it, was the fact that we saw that even though Chazal came up with this whole idea called the prohibition of Bishul Akum, but partially because of that, there really would have been no prohibition to begin with, they built in certain leniencies. So, for example, to mention two of the more well-known ones, one was the fact that any food that's edible raw, even if it's cooked completely by a non-Jew, is nevertheless permissible. We discussed, again, not to go over in detail now, we discussed what if a food is eaten in one part of the world raw but not another part of the world. If you remember, we saw Rabbi Ganak's article and he was mentioning, by allusion, sushi, how at the time he wrote this article almost 20 years ago, so then it was still not a Western phenomenon, cult phenomenon like it is now. And there's no doubt that changes the halacha. And if you'd be in America 20 years ago and no one was eating raw fish, so then maybe that's a prohibited food. But if in today's day and age in America, you're in the Western world, people are eating raw fish, then that changes the halacha. The second example of perhaps the most well-known leniency which is built in was the Queen of England idea. Namely, Chazal said that only food that was appropriate to be ola al shacha malachim, it was eaten by nobility, and we saw it doesn't just have to be a king or a queen, it could even be the czar in his day, or for that matter, the White House or the president in our day. Food which was considered fancy enough, as we saw the machlokas about sardines, by the way, we generally assume, not just that they would eat it, you know, to take President Bush example, maybe while he's watching TV on a Sunday football game or something, so he eats pretzels or whatever, he's eating beer nuts or something, snacking away, not nosh, but what he has when he has Prime Minister Blair over, a state dinner or something like that. So that kind of a fancy food. Food that's not that fancy, also lenient, even if it's completely cooked by a Jew. A non-Jew, excuse me. So that was two examples, and we, again, not reviewing all the details. But where we are today, in our concluding shiur, is part 3 of the third part of the course. Namely, that in this course, all of the things that I mentioned before, it's not royalty, it's edible raw, those are factors which make a food lenient and permissible, despite the fact that, in reality, it was Bishul Akum, a non-Jew cooked it. There is a whole final category of leniencies, which is based on the assumption that based on certain participation of a Jew, the process can be defined not as Bishul Akum, but as Bishul Yisrael. Namely, that, again, if a Jew would completely cook the food, so then that's nothing to talk about. The point is that it's not an all or nothing. Chazal did allow certain participation to be considered significant and sufficient in order to be counted as that. So we discussed initially a debate about what if a Jew just turns on the fire? So does it have to be when the food is ready in the oven or on the burner? Is it sufficient to do it ahead of time? Things such as this, we saw machlokim zishachar and rama, etc. And generally the pattern which we saw with our most recent shir, is that the Shulchan Aruch was much more machmir. And for Sfardim to this day and age, there are more restrictions on this. However, the Ramah was more lenient. And even though we have seen the first part of the Ramah, I divided it up into two parts. We only studied the first part together, and basically all of tonight's shir is based on the second part. Just for the sake of review, why don't we begin by reading the Ramah at the outset, and that way we'll just review that, and then we'll be ready to go to the underlined part, which is the second half, which is what's really the basis of tonight's shir. So after the Shulchan Aruch had been gave his restrictive position, you'll see what the Ramah's leniency is for Ashkenazim. At the top of the page, Yesh Cholkin, Sphere Luhu, and they hold the Hadlokas Ha'esh, it's sufficient to just turn on the fire. Or even Chitui B'Gechalim, that means, as we said, to stoke the coals, to mish it around, which, of course, as we know, will either make it quicker or a little bit more intensive if it was dulling, to keep the fire going. Because those are both, that's considered significant enough participation. L'inyan Bishul Kamal Inyan Pas. These are Heterim which are already on the books. On the books in a chapter earlier in Shulchan Aruch, it's the previous chapter, Kuf Yud Beis, 112. This is chapter Kuf Yud Gimel. Those are the laws of Pas Akum. And there are certain leniencies. The Shulchan Aruch has said, that's apples and oranges, or that's bread, and this is not bread. The Ramah was saying, no, we can apply the leniencies which we already know are on the books about bread to cooking other foods. And therefore, those two acts are considered sufficient. Now that is, I say, a leniency of the Ramah, but if you will, a mainstream leniency. Namely, that there was major authorities on both sides of the issue in Rishonim, and the Ramah and the Shulchan Aruch had a machlokas, had a paskin. That was what we saw until now. We, again, in the previous year, we saw that from the Gemara through the Rishonim, we developed this machlokas. But once the Ramah has this foundation, right, he took a little bit of step out onto the ice, so then he starts walking further and further, and the Ramah is going to add now more and more leniencies, which of course don't get off the ground if you don't start with his assumptions, but once you accept the first thing which we saw, which as Ashkenazim we do, then the Ramah starts jumping, as I say, a little bit further out into the thin part of the ice. And here is the basis of tonight's shir. The Yesh Omrim, underline part. That it's not just if the Jew turned on the oven before there was any food, and it's not just if the Jew stoked the coals. Afilu lo chita Yisrael. Even if he didn't stoke any coals. Velo hishlich sham kisen. He didn't throw any wood splinters or wood chips in to help increase the fire. Even if he didn't do that. Rak shakusis hidliko ha'esh. Ha'esh shal Yisrael shari. I'm not sure why out of nowhere here, other than that perhaps is the case of the authority he's quoting, he decided out of nowhere to switch to the feminine gender, but, example with a female non-Jew. But the bottom line, he says, what's the case? The case is where a non-Jew cooked food with a fire that had been lit from a fire started by a Jew. Right? It's Boy Scouts. Or for that matter, second day Yontif when you're lighting from the Yahrzeit candle, right? For the, right, you have a
like, really.
That's why I said we're on the thin part of the ice now. So the Jew lights the candle, lights the match, lights whatever, and that's a fire. Then comes along the non-Jew and takes a candle from that and puts that in and starts a fire.
That's like the pilot light
thing. We're going to get to that. That's where we're getting to. Obviously, it didn't exist in the time of the Ramah, but that's where the halakhic imagination ran in more modern times. So that is a major leniency. However, it's worth noting, perhaps you're sharp enough as a group that I think we've been learning in an ideal way, namely in consecutive weeks. You might have picked up on this, but let's see if you're really, really impressive and can pick up on it despite the fact that we're all rusty. The truth is that Ramah told us two things here that we never knew before. Until now, we had heard of two leniencies of the Ramah. One was if you turn the fire on even before there was any food on it. Number two is if, even though the food's under it, you start stoking and mishing around. We just explicitly mentioned that the Shulchan Ramah adds what I'm going to call, I'll give you a hint, a fourth thing. Namely that if you lead a fire that leads to a fire, two steps removed. But before that, he implied what would be in sequence a third heter, which also we had never seen before until tonight. Namely, just look at the words.
Kavanah?
No, we didn't read that tonight. And we did study that 2 weeks ago. Yeah, just yet. I'm giving you a hint. It's all in the underlined part. It comes from what is altogether in this Rama, four words. Should I read you the four words? I did already, actually, but I'll. In velo hishlich sham kisu. We had never seen that before that it would work. That's also a new thing. That's not turning on the fire beforehand. That's not mishing the fire during. That's throwing in a wood chip. And he writes it, and it's even in the singular.
But isn't that the same thing as stoking? I mean, we're talking about a very insignificant act.
Who said, no, because stoking the coals is not considered insignificant.
Okay, fine, these are all considered significant acts in terms of the shalakam, but in terms of actual activity.
No, I don't think so. Meaning, the Shulchan Aruch might not even accept it, but there's no question if anyone's ever been at a campfire. Right. Stoking the coals is very important. It's not the same thing as the guy who actually cooked, which is why maybe the Shulchan Aruch doesn't accept it. But compare that to the guy who throws in one twig. Right? That is obviously even more and more removed. So it's interesting. The Ramah didn't say that that works. But when he's trying to build up, because even he's aware that what he actually says explicitly is the biggest chiddush, a fire to a fire. But he's saying, and even if you didn't light the fire yourself, but even if you didn't do that, and even if you didn't throw in a wood chip, what's the implication? If you would throw in a wood chip, so who makes that diuk? Just gonna get it's interesting, and we'll see. It'll be very important to an issue in which the entire halakhic universe in modern days has discussed, and the center of that universe is none other than Baltimore, Maryland. And it all comes from these four words, that the Ramah implies that it's sufficient to do as minimal an act as throwing in a wood chip. Who infers that from the Ramah? None other than the great Shach. Look at the second source. Mashma, it implies, again, the Ramah doesn't come out and say it, but he implies, the Sfira Leila HaRamah, that the Ramah holds, the Ha de Mahani Kisein Eitz, I'm reading the wrong one, sorry. Abal Hishlech, I'm sorry, Mashma. But if you did, in fact, Hishlech Kisim, you threw in a wood chip, Moel Gam Bebishuli Ove Kochavim. And he quotes others who in fact say this explicitly. So we now have, according to the Ramah, four different possibilities in order to transform an act which admittedly is being done primarily by a non-Jew, but halachically can have the status of Bishul Yisrael. You turn on the fire itself. At the time we thought that was controversial, now we realize that's on firm ground, relatively speaking, or you stoke the coals, or you throw in a wood chip or two, you help increase the fire very minimally, but the heat, the fire, very minimally, or fourth, most removed, you light a fire, which then leads to a second fire, which the food is cooked under. Yeah. These are all shitas quoted in the Ramah, and it's these last two that we will analyze tonight. Yes?
Is it fair to say that given that they didn't have pilot lights, and the chance of somebody going over to a Jew taking a light, it's a way of him saying, as long as it was involved in any way, shape, or form, I'm going to say it's okay.
That's what the Ramah holds.
No, he's giving these examples, not like that's like these examples that, it's not the wood chip that matters so much. He's just saying if there's any way.
Listen, we could come up with all sorts of, and if I give him a massage while he's leaning over the oven for 10 hours, you know, that could help too. But the point is there are lines, and the Ramah is telling you what the lines are. Yes. Yeah, the answer, Enochanami. He is drawing a very broad picture of how little is enough. Sometimes, you know, less is more in this case. It's enough. It's sufficient, according to him.
There's obviously the fire. So he's not saying that if you peel the potato or if you...
Correct. Correct. That's too far removed. But again, you could easily have imagined that you held his general principle, but thought that Hashlachas Kisim was too far removed. Or that Eish La'Eish is too far removed. But he holds that all these things are okay. Right? Four things that he holds are okay. So far, so good?
It's like literally you can strike a match. That makes sense.
Yes. Maybe even less. That's what we have to see.
Think about that.
No, not that little. Okay. Now, let's move on to the third source. The Chalkas Binyamin. That's the contemporary Sefer on Bishul Akum on the area of Shulchan Aruch by Binyamin Cohen. Mishum Desfir Le'el Ramah. What does he hold? Tahoda mahane kisim. Right? No one until now had ever said anything about just throwing in a wood chip when it came to Bishalakum. But he says, Mishum de mahani, because such a thing does exist already on the books and does help Eitzel Pas, there is such a heter on the books when it comes to bread. So understood the Ramah, lav mishum kula de pasu, umishum de esh b'chayei nefesh. The reason we had, again, it's an extenuating heter by bread too. And don't think that it's a unique heter limited to bread, because after all, bread is so central and bread is the staff of life. And therefore, and it's true, we have certain leniencies by bread, which we don't have for other things, because of bread's importance. And presumably those who would argue on this Ramah would say that heter stays in the bread halachos, it doesn't come to the cooking broccoli or whatever. But the Ramah said, no, apparently he held that that's not true. Ella, underlined, demidinahu demahani. Rather, it's not a special leniency of bread. Rather, when it works in bread, it works in the letter of the law. Mishum de'ein lecha kol kisim v'kisim she'enu mosif b'choma esh. Bottom line is, even if it's so minimal, every single piece of wood increases the heat of the fire, and in that way is contributing. Again, well, obviously we have acknowledged, you could never distinguish, and under, you know, yes, it cooked this much quicker because you threw that in, and, you know, if you had a thermometer in, would it really go up in temperature? Maybe, but you wouldn't notice it on your own. You bring your hand before and bring it after. Right? Nevertheless, because we can take it as a given that more wood equals more heat, bigger fire equals more heat, so if you throw in a log, that'll make a huge difference, and if you throw in a little wood chip, it's incremental, it's teeny, it's unnoticeable, but since it is exists on some level, empirically, even if we can't notice it ourselves, it is sufficient. That apparently is the Ramah's opinion, and thus understood, we will have to see, does it serve as the basis for some even more innovative modern heterim? But that is seems to be the Ramah's going out on the ledge. Now the question is, we've seen the Ramah go out on this ledge. So does the Shulchan Aruch hold like this? 100% obviously. Not, Shulchan Aruch doesn't hold of the first of the four heterim, let alone as they get progressively more liberal. But the question is, those of us in the Ashkenazic world who accept the basic principle of the Ramah, do we go so far as to accept the Ramah in his entirety? Which would, of course, make for as many leniencies as possible. So here we have a major, it may be more than this, but I will, I hope, relatively clearly and succinctly show you a four-way machlokas of major heavy hitter, you know, poskim living right at, you know, at the time and right after the Ramah. So look at the fourth source. We're back to our Shach. The Shach is actually commenting on the next halacha, which has nothing directly to do with this. And he is defending the position of the Ramah there. But just parenthetically, in passing, he says, V'yeshlu l'hashiv al dvarav. He goes, I could answer, because again, he's defending this. V'kanein makom l'arech, but I don't want to get into the details now. After all, basically, says the Shach, ki l'may de kaimelan, after all, since we hold the afilu hidlik Yisrael ha'esh, that if it's enough, that if the Jew just lit the original fire, or even hishlich kisem, shari, da-da-da-da-da. He just throws that in passing. But poskim have picked up on this, and they have pointed to the fact that you see the Shach, he embraces the Ramah in totality. We follow the Ramah, we follow Ashkenazic custom. If the Ramah had these big leniencies, he had broad shoulders, broad enough to carry us, we will follow the Ramah. That's, you know, two pretty heavy hitters. The Ramah and the Shach are a tough tag team to beat. And they are taking this most liberal position, the most lenient position. All four of these things apparently work. And we haven't yet discussed, but in absence of saying anything, for now we will assume that that means even l'chadchila, even ideally. You can just do you can pull these, quote, tricks out of the hat, and then you'll be okay. We didn't get to it yet. We will see that that's some posts can do.
But did the Ramah make a difference?
So you tell me. We'll see that debated also.
Okay. Didn't know if I missed it last week.
No. We're going to get to it. No, we didn't discuss any of this. Was not discussed yet today. Now, again, the first parts of the Ramah, presumably that's for sure l'chachila. The question is when he adds these things, and I would include 2 through 4, let alone 3 and 4. Mm-hmm. Oh, I take it back. Let's 3 and 4 we'll focus on. That's the question. Is that l'chachila or not? So for now, let's assume yes. So in the Chalkas Binyamin, again, that's a very helpful and useful sefer, this contemporary sefer, he collects a few other positions, and that's so instead of quoting all of those primary sources, I thought it would be easier in one place to see his summary of the machlokas here. Because as I said, there's really three other opinions out there. Again, even within the world of Ashkenaz, let alone Sfarad. So he says the following. Umashme mi divrei harama ta'afilu l'charchila noagin lismoch al hadlokas esh o chitoi b'gacholim. So he's talking about the first two. If the Jew lit the fire and then the non-Jew put the pot on the oven, or you give a mish, you stoke the coals. And it's clear, as I just told you a minute ago, that there are more holes that is good and it's even ideal. But he says, Omnom, however, l'inyan halacha, l'maisa, practically, how do we paskin, ha-postim ha-poim acharei ha-rama, who holds like this subsequently? The yesh mehem, namely the shach, who we just saw momentarily a moment ago, pasku chavaseh. They hold like the Ramah. They've accepted the Ramah, hook, line, and sinker. And not just the first two. It seems like from the Shach, 1, 2, 3, and 4. He holds all of the Heterim. However, there are three other positions that he quotes here. Number one, very important. Da'as, well, I'll call it two. The Ramah will be known as number one now. What's the second position? Da'as Hagra, the Vilna Gaon. L'chalik Bazeh, he says, we're not going to take, the Ramah is not an all-or-nothing party. It's a smorgasbord, and we can take what we like and leave what we don't like. Das Hagra lechalik. He distinguishes. Bazeh bein bazeh dechitoy gecholim v'hashlochas kitim mahani. This is interesting. Until now, we have focused, and for good reason, because I think most others other than the Gra hold like this, that it's not just that the Ramah has four isolated heterim. They get progressively more lenient. The Ramah, the Vilna Gaon, in his originally brilliant way, has a different take on it. He said, he quotes here now, positions 2 and 3. You stoke the coals, or you just throw in a little bitty, teeny-weeny wood chip. Says the Vilna Gaon, I accept the Ramah for 2 and 3. Ava hadlaka sa'esh, number 1. You turn on a fire, a complete fire raging, which is going to be the fire that cooks the food. But it's before the food was on the fire. So it's an orphaned fire until the non-Jew decides to make use of it and put the food on. Lo mahani. Again, not much effort, we can easily speculate and not, or understand both sides of the issue. The more simple way, which we were assuming until now, is if you, the Jew, turn the full force of the fire, which is going to be what cooks the food, so that's very contributory. That's significant. And that's better than the subsequent things where you only contributed negligibly. However, apparently the Vilna Gaon holds differently. He holds, ladies,
the food needs to be there.
Because without that, it doesn't matter how much you did, what's to connect your act
to the cooking?
To the cooking. The one who made that connection was all the non-Jew. You didn't contribute in any way to that. So he holds, ironically, he doesn't comment on number four, which may lead us to believe that he rejects that too. But 2 and 3 he holds like. Number 1 he does not hold like. Okay?
Well, number 4 is really connected to number 1 because...
It's a kavachomer that that's not going to work.
Right.
Good. Well said. Good. V'hataz hichriya bazet. Now we have another well-known authority, the Taz. He passes the following. We do take an all or nothing, but the all or nothing has a new variable. Where is all of this happening? It's a friend, it's a maid, a cook, you know, somebody who's in your house cooking. Yesh lo hakel. Bein b'chitoi, bein b'hadlak asesh, whatever the things are, it's okay. Aval b'beis nachri, yesh lo hachmir kahamachaber. But if this is taking place in a non-Jewish home, and for that matter it could be a restaurant, let's say, I think, it's not in your house, or a Jewish private home, so then, despite the fact that Taz was an Ashkenazi and more often than not would follow the Ramah, in this case, he takes the Sephardic approach. So he, for the Taz, it's an all or nothing, but he introduces a new variable. Where does it take place?
Isn't that, going back to early Shirim, where the whole point of this, isn't that antithetical, the opposite of what you would think? If the point is to avoid intimacy, then having them in your house would make it worse, not better. Sometimes you can't get out of it to have them in your house. If you have to entertain clients or whatever it is, I mean, whatever you have.
But the whole point.
We saw, if I'm not mistaken, I believe we saw. Again, we didn't accept it, and the truth is that this Taz is not accepted either.
Right.
and certainly not Chumrah.
Right.
But we saw, you could make an argument, you can make an argument that when they're doing it in your house, so to speak, under your auspices, you know, it's the ideal, really, and this is, I guess, where it's coming from, is, you know, the idea of, you know, so to speak, the ideal, when I say ideal, meaning the most pure bad case. You know, the fullest expression of, I'm going to be so beholden to him, snowball leading, you know, domino effect, Mazel Tov, right, Reverend just married you, is, I would think, your friend invites you over to his house and prepares you lunch or dinner. And as there you're going to his house, you're really on his turf, so to speak, and really beholden to him. Here, where someone's naked in your house, it may even be the most likely explanation for that to begin with is it's probably a worker of yours. It doesn't have to be, but it's certainly much more likely. And there were, again, not that we accepted those chachila, but we did see, going back to Rishonim, if I remember correctly, those who wanted to suggest that that should always be lenient, because when you have that imbalance of power, right, it's not just a modern concept which they speak about in terms of, you know, bosses and their employees. The Chazal understood that also, or at least some suggested, that the worry of, it wasn't like the prince and the frog. You know, the princess, you know, the rich Jewish person who has the manor is not necessarily going to be worried about an intermarriage with the maid. But, so that's, again, we didn't accept the halacha completely, although we did mention that certain cases we would use that as a contributory heter. If there were other reasons to be makel, we would throw that on to be supportive evidence. But if it's in your house, there are possibly more and more makel. And the Taz is picking up on that, train of thought. Finally, we have the Chachmas Odom, a last underlined part. He also takes all or nothing, but he takes what would be a more, I would have expected somebody to say this, more than Taz's suggestion, and that is, ideally, you throw out everything. Ideally, you shouldn't rely on any of these things. We should all be smart. In other words, we should all rely on them. Afilo Beis Yisrael, it doesn't matter, whatever the heter I just spent 2 minutes explaining to you or hypothesizing. The Chachmas Adam says ideally you shouldn't rely on any of that stuff. But Aval Bashas Hadchak, if you're in a difficult situation, Obedyevit, or it's already too late, there was a case where you stoked the coals, but Lamaisa, that's all you did. Yesh Lahokil Karama Afilu Beis Akum. Then on the other extreme, we can always rely on the Ramah. So if you have a case where it already happened, or, and this is again, we speak to people in commercial kashrus, for whatever the details are, there are, I don't know if it's often or every now and then, but it's certainly not unheard of, where you have cases isolated, factories out who knows where, it's not shayach to have a mashkiach there full time because who wants to live in Timbuktu or whatever. Whatever the scenario is, there are times where we have to rely, they're very difficult shas attacks. This, you know, if you wanted to take the purest ideal sheet of the Shulchan Aruch, we won't be able to give ashkacha to such a place. So in such a case, that's a shas adchak. So says the Chachmas Adam, then you can rely on the Ramah. Or what if you lit the fire, then he lit the fire from you? It sounds like also you can rely on him if he did it already. It's b'diavad. Four positions. The Ramah has all the leniencies. The Shach also held like that. The Vilna Gaon said, well, 2 and 3, yes. 1 and 4, no. The Taz says all or nothing. It depends on where you are, his house or ours. And the Chachmas Adam says it all a question of ideally and b'diavad. Okay? So, bottom line, where these cases become most practical, bottom line is certainly b'diavad, you would be makel. You have the Shach, the Ramah, and the Chachmas Adam to rely on. If you threw in the fact that it was in your house, you could have the Taz too. So, to the extent that this would come up in one's house, ideally you may even have a leg to stand on, but certainly, b'diavad, we would never, say you can't eat the food in these cases. The real issues which are complicated and I think interesting and worth studying now for a few minutes are the two modern cases that have come up, that have been discussed. One is not so relevant anymore because, as I understand it, they're not making ovens this way anymore. But there was a question which was brought up, I don't know the technological history of this, but it's not that long ago, of the original pilot light concept. The pilot light concept was that you had some of them for the oven, some for the burners. You had a light that was on. In theory, it was on indefinitely. It often blew out, something spilled on it, but in theory, it could go forever.
Some of us still have these prehistoric
ones. Right. Well, again, there's different... The point, I think, that what is important for this case is you have an oven in which you have that pilot light, and if you turn on, let's say, the burners, certainly a gas burner is easiest to conceive of it, and then that, I don't know how exactly that works, but that pilot light ignites the fire that is the source of the heat. Now that is, without, frankly, it's actually very direct. It's not, you don't need to be so imaginative to see the connection. That is a modern technological example of which heter of the Rama?
The fourth.
Very good. Aish from Aish. So the question is, what will you say if a Jew turned on that pilot light a week ago, a month ago, never been seen from again? And the non-Jew's turning off the burner and on the burner and off the burner and on the burner and cooking everything. And it's Olah Shechem Olachem, it's Mamish, you know, breaded veal and delicious. Oh. Schmuck.
It's probably a stretch.
So that's the question. Could you be lenient in such a case? Now, as I say, I'm not sure how many ovens are still made this way. Now you have all the modern ovens with their own problems. You have to read the Starkey website for all the Shabbos ovens, which create more problems, it seems like, than they solve, and whatever. I'm not holding in this because we have a pretty old oven in our house, too. Certainly not a fancy one with a Shabbos mode, which causes problems because it goes off on Yom Tov, whatever. You're all probably more familiar with this than I am. Okay, so let's see a few of the sources. So if you look at the second to last source on the page, Chalkas Binyamin or Binyamin Cohn, again, he's the most recent one to mention this. There were people who discussed it well before him, but it was a convenient source to cite for you. He quotes this Ramah, again, heter number 4 of the Ramah, and then he says the following, Ulefizeh, based on this, Nir de Osam Tanurim, de Eshbem Esh Ketana, those ovens that have a little fire, Hadolekes Tamid, which remains constantly lit, if you turn on the gas thing, nidla kagaz me'ezu, the gas burner will be lit from that. Imi tchila hidlik Yisrael osa esh katana, if the Jew lit the original pilot light, uba akum apitech as a gaz, and then the non-Jew came and turned on the burner, ubisha lovin, cooked on it, motor, it should be okay. Sharia akum hidlik ha'esh me'esh al Yisrael. It's exactly a modern example of what the Ramah talked about. So, do we accept this? It certainly makes it logical sense. If we accept the Ramah, we should accept this too. So if you look at the last source here, this is a tshuva written, an internal OU, tshuva. The two major postgame to OU are Rav Hirschel Schachter and Rav Yisrael Belsky. So Belsky's day job, so to speak, full-time job, is he is one of the Rosh Hashivas at Tar V'Das in Brooklyn. And he's also, again, the very senior postdoc at the OU. So he wrote the following. Bahad in Nahagul Lismoch, that which some have the practice of relying on. Basha Akum Madlik Esh, may pilot light. Can you close the door, please? If a non-Jew lights a fire from a pilot light, Shehidlik Yisrael Esh, that the Jew had originally lit. So obviously there were those who were Mekel based on this. What is Rabbi Belsky's opinion? Yesh la'orer, ki yisod ha'heter banoi al devrei ha'ramah. So listen, where are they getting it from? It's only based on an extension of the Ramah. Now, what about the Ramah himself? He says, umash ma'uta, shu mozer l'chachila. It's mashma that he holds, that the Ramah holds about it himself, that it's not that this works even l'chachila. However, it can't be. Mihu... Makor Hadin may sefer Isser V'Heter. There's a sefer called Isser V'Heter. In fact, if you look up at the Ramah, what's the number 4, which is what we're talking about. What is after that? I have in parentheses. Aleph Vav Hey. Right, last line of the first source. Right, that's the source. The Ramah was taking this source. The Isser V'Heter is the one who said, Eish L'Eish. But if you look up the original, which is always good scholarship to look the original up, says Rav Belsky, if you look it up there, V'sham muchach, there it's clear, to lo hiter ele b'di'eved. The Isser V'Heter himself, who's the basis of this, is only willing to rely on this b'di'eved. Furthermore, v'gam b'sefer chachmas adam, which we saw before. The Chachmas Sadam says, I'll accept all of the Ramah's Heterim, even number four, but only Vidyevid. So if that's the case, what's the bottom line? Ho'il v'harama lo higdil heter. The Ramah himself, it seems like, is willing to be makel even l'chachila. But we have a tension, because we have these other heavy hitter poskim, who are only willing to be makel Vidyevid in less than ideal situations. So Rabbi Belsky concludes, Ula yesh makom lahatir heichad yefsher b'inyan acher ushasad chaked of the dummy. We don't just have to rely. It's not just in a case where you already cook the food and then the shayla is you bring it to the rabbi. Am I allowed to eat it or not? It says in any case which is somewhat difficult to find another heter. And as I said, this in theory this could relate to a case in one's home, but it's certainly more likely even and definitely does happen in cases in certain commercial situations, restaurants or plants. In which a more active Jewish participation is impossible. So here, if you have a mashgiach who comes in once a day, once a week, or whatever, so assuming, again, you'll have to trust them that the pilot didn't burn out and they turn on their own. Okay, that's a separate consideration, which is not the topic of tonight's shiur. But the bottom line is, in theory, you could have a mashgiach come into a restaurant or to a factory once a week, once a month, who knows, turn on the pilot light, and if there's no other situation, again, Rebelsky is clearly saying it's not ideal, but if there's no other way around it, there is room to rely on it based on this Ramah, but it does seem to be a little bit.
He says you rely on it any time with the Evid, but does he say you
can rely on it? Shasat Chak, could the Evid dummy. Last end of the line.
Okay.
Hecha di Yevsher ben Yenacher. You have no other solution.
But this.
Shasat Chak, could the Evid dummy. The Evid means it already happened.
Right.
Shasat Chak, it didn't happen yet, but you're in a difficult situation. This is a well-known phrase in Halacha, that sometimes we say, if you're in a difficult situation, even though it's before the fact, but a difficult situation before the fact is like a bad situation after the fact. We have a right to be lenient in such cases.
I guess it's sort of like, you know, like, you get children involved, you got older parents.
Right.
And they hire a
caregiver. If you have a caregiver at home, as I say, either as a babysitter or a maid or a home nurse or something, these are very important shailas to either be clear on yourself or before you engage such a person to give a call to the rabbi and go over these halachos. And I think, my impression, unfortunately, is that not too many people do it.
My grandmother had this, we worked on them and everything else, and after she died, we found ham stuck in the back.
Oh, that's a different issue.
So I'm saying, you go through everything, but at the end of the day, you're leaving them alone there.
You have to trust these other people. Right. Well, listen, whatever, I don't know the situation in your case, but obviously, it would be ideal if, the family members checked up, certainly in the beginning, you know, to see what was going on. But I'm just saying, all I can tell you is I get shailas regularly, havelos, chasnida, who knows what. I don't yet think a single person has asked me one of these shailas. So I can't tell you what's going on with other shuls, and I don't know what's going on with people in the shul, but I can tell you they're not asking me. So maybe they'll know the halacha, so it's okay. Maybe they're asking you guys. Ooh, who are the guys? Who are the women who are going to shear? Let's ask them. Anyway, these aren't, but you're right.
That has to be a common problem.
I can't comment. I don't know.
That sounds,
What can I tell you?
Unless everybody's all in institutions.
All right, let's see the last source on this, and then we'll go to the final topic. So this is this English pamphlet that I've quoted before, Halacha Brura, which is, it's written by a young fellow, but it's actually written and based on the positions, and it's actually reviewed by the same Rabbi Belsky we quoted before. So it's can be considered faithful to his position. So we can pretty much guess where he's going to conclude, but I wanted to include it because he added something else. So first of all, in the first paragraph, he says, by the way, again, I mentioned this before, and since our last class tonight, I'll mention it again. Content-wise, I've found this to be very helpful, but you shouldn't think that because I'm quoting it, I endorse his use of English language and other things. Again, I didn't write this. I typed it on the sheet, to be honest, but I'm quoting as he wrote. The verbs, the adjectives that he uses are the ones that I use, just because I was quoting from him. But if this was more formal, I'd be writing sick all over the place. That's what you do when you're quoting someone who doesn't write through case. Okay, Nunu. So in the opening paragraph, he writes the basic summary position that, since we're not really sure we can hold on to this Ramah, if pilot lights are based on the Ramah, it should only be with the Evid. Then he adds something which I had never seen in any other place. He writes that it has been reported that Moshe Feinstein was not happy with the practice of relying on a pilot light. I think this is what you might have been getting at before, because the pilot light burns indefinitely, and it is difficult to consider this a perpetual Eish Yisrael. In other words, even though on some logical level it is an extension of the Ramah, there's no question that in the Ramah's time, he was referring to you light the candle like from the Abdallah candle to the Abdallah candle, so to speak. This idea that I'm going to turn it on once and walk away for a week, let alone longer, it's very far removed. It's, you know, it seems to be minimally violating the spirit of the heter. And apparently, again, I don't know what his source was. I don't remember anymore. But he says this is quoted in the name of Moshe. That's another consideration not to do it. And as he concludes, and this is, again, this is exactly what the OU's position is, that they certainly not in an ideal situation, they would not rely exclusively on the pilot light heter. But if they had no other choice, or they were using that as a backup. In other words, you have the pilot light lit by the mashgiach. So you have that already on the books. Then you try one of the other things. But if one of those things don't work, the mashgiach doesn't come that day, whatever, so then you have that as a fallback. That seems to be the consensus opinion. So now we're ready for our last topic, which is, you know, appropriately so, where Baltimore takes center stage in the halakhic universe. Many in Baltimore think this is true all the time. But and maybe it is true often. But it is certainly true in this case. That no one will doubt. The reason is because of the following, which was published by Rabbi Heinemann. Look what he says. Would a light bulb or glow plug that was turned on by a Yehudi and was burning continuously qualify for Bishul Yisrael? We've all seen this, whether it's in, what's it called, Kosher Bite here? Or Kosher Delight or one of these places, any of these fast food places, where you go up to get the food and the fries or the hamburgers have been made 4 yovels ago. All right, they're sitting on the soggy bun, or the french fries are, but they're not cold. Why are they not cold? Because they're sitting under that heat light. Some people, I've been in homes where, for example, in certain cases in the bathroom, have this, right? Some people like to air dry or whatever from the shower. I've seen this. You walk out of the shower, and people have this as a light option in their bathroom. And it's actually, the one that I was in, it was actually pretty hot then. I wish my hamburgers were that hot. So Rabbi Heinemann, and this is quintessential Rabbi Heinemann because it combines his two loves and his two talents, namely a brilliant halachic insight, but also, for those who know, Rabbi Heinemann is very mechanical, very hands-on. And Rabbi Heinemann, again, he might have had people helping him with some of the installation, but basically, he didn't just invent this in a safer theoretically. Practically, he invented a system whereby you could put one of these lights into and inside an oven. Just the technological wherewithal is impressive. And that is turned on by a separate thing. In other words, there's a separate cord or plug or outlet to turn that light on. What happens if the Jew, the Mashkiach, turns that on? And in theory, I don't know what the shelf life of that is, but it's probably longer and more reliable than a pilot light. Again, if it's electric, I don't know the source of it. If it's electric, it could go forever if it's plugged in. Maybe it could get tripped. I don't know exactly what would make it go out. Maybe nothing, unless it accidentally tripped or something on the cord. But let's say a Jew turned that light on, and that's inside the oven cavity. And then the non-Jew comes and turns on his oven and cooks his food. So let's think. You're going to fire up the oven to 400 degrees to make the pizza, to make the Chinese noodles, whatever you're making. I don't know. Is it 2 degrees? Is it 1 degree? Is it 3 degrees? Some, but it can't be much more than that. Let's be honest, right? I don't know exactly what it is, and a quick call to the Star K could probably get us an answer. But I think everyone would admit, including behind him, it's obviously much smaller than the rest of the other heat. Right? It's like what I've mentioned in the past when you have these Shabbos candles providing light in your dining room with your thousands of kilowatts coming out of the ceiling. And how much light do those little candles add to the room? And Poskim in our day and age have discussed that about, because the whole purpose of the lights is supposed to be, of the candles to be adding light. So are you really Yotze if you're lighting in a room with kajillions of watts? So that'd be another topic, not tonight. But it's a similar, by analogy, it's a similar phenomenon. They're contributing it a little bit, but we all realize that's not the dominant force. The food would cook plenty fine without the little bulb in there.
Idea that it goes in opposition to the
Lagon
because the food isn't there beforehand.
For sure. Who said anything about the Lagon? Okay. Who needs the Gon? We didn't get to answer yet. We just asked the question. So Rabbi Heinemann says, the minimum halachic requirement for Bishul Yisrael is Hashlachas Kisim. Namely, number 3. Heinemann fully embraces the heter number 3 of the Ramah. Literally, to throw a small wood chip into the fire. And this is how Rabbi Heinemann understands that. Any minor action that contributes heat, and apparently it's even minimal, to the cooking would qualify for Bishul Yisrael. And therefore, here comes the original position. If the oven would be hot-wired so that a bulb or a glow bar could be placed in the oven cavity, turned on by Yehudi, and left on permanently, the additional heat given off by the light bulb or a glow plug, which is considered fire, would more than qualify. Right? He added the more. He didn't need to, but obviously he wanted to write that. More than qualify for Hashlachas Kisim and would fulfill the requirements of Bishul Yisrael. Says Rabbi Hyman, listen, how much heat did the little wood chip add in the big picture? And yet the Rambam said it was okay. The glow plug is at least as good as that. And to the best of my knowledge, I imagine internationally where they give Hashkachas, and I assume more Nafkamina, right? I don't know, is David Chu's under this star K? I'm guessing that they rely on this. Now maybe this is a local restaurant and they have a regular mashkiach, maybe they don't need to, but certainly they would. I assume that they would answer you very freely, or at least they would answer me if I asked them, you know, which are the restaurants and which ones in Baltimore rely on this. I have always assumed that there must be some. It's not just a cooler that Rabbi Hyman made up in theory. He made it up because they're using it in Star K establishments, whether it's in Baltimore or somewhere else. That's my assumption.
Wouldn't you use this for things like factories? Not necessarily, because you're going to have another mashkiach anyway. If you go to a fancy restaurant here, I'm sure the mashkiach anyways.
Maybe he can't always be there. They want to start cooking at 9 in the morning. But you're right. There might be places that need it for more extenuating circumstances. So it is my impression that, at least in the established commercial kosher world, this is very well known and completely rejected by every other organization. Certainly, I know that the official position of the OU is to reject it. And it may very well be that others, I think, do as well. So, two sources just to give you the general gist of that. The next one here, I had it on my computer saved as an article, but I can't remember where I got it from, so that's why you don't have any bibliographical information. But the article is written by someone named Rabbi Yaakov Luban. Rabbi Luban is one of the senior people. He's underneath Rabbi Belsky, but he's a senior person at the OU. He also happens to be a Rav of a big shul in Highland Park, New Jersey. If you know people who live there. Very wonderful person. He often writes very creative articles in Jewish Action, the OU magazine. Anyway, so Rabbi Luban wrote the following. It's interesting, and I imagine it's out of respect, but both articles that I saw that quoted this and rejected it never mentioned Rabbi Hyman or the Star K by name. So I assume it was by respect, because they were going to come down so hard on it. They didn't. But I could be wrong. I never asked the authors. Various poskim have argued against the light bulb system. Right? He had quoted, again, he didn't quote it by name, but he quoted the light bulb, and then he says, when a Jew adds a wood chip to a fire, it is rendered Eish Yisrael because the Jew is instrumental in preparing and intensifying the fire. By contrast, a light bulb remains separate and distinct from the fire. In other words, you have two separate sources of heat in that oven cavity. You have the oven itself, and then you have the light bulb. And the Jew is not a contributor to the prime source of heat. So says Rabbi Luban, again, and I'm sure it's based on others, not just his own personal argument. Rabbi Hyman may be right that it's equivalent in terms of the degrees of heat. But there's a huge difference, says Rabbi Luban. In the case of the wood chip, it's negligible, but at least whatever you'll say contributes, it gets engulfed in the same body of heat that is cooking the food to begin with. Here it remains constantly separate. It's not only negligible, and it certainly couldn't cook the food on its own, it's separate from the primary source of heat. Others have raised another interesting objection. Electric companies typically change the source of power from one generator to another. Meaning, again, something that I assume is unnoticeable to you or I, even if it happens X times a day or a week, and our lights stay on. But they change the generators. Even if a Jew installs a light bulb, it would no longer be considered fire of a Jew if the generator was subsequently changed by an electric company. In halakhic terminology, this was referred to as kolulo chitov. Chitov meaning his arrows, i.e. his action, has ended. Right, this is, you can imagine, in halakhic terminology, they didn't have the kind of power and electrical force, you know, that we have, but the again, conceptually, when Chazal were talking about these types of principles, which modern-day poets have applied to electricity and other things, it's interesting, again, if you've never heard this before, they thought about, imagine, if you don't, you have to think about it for a moment, it's really ingenious, a bow and arrow. In other words, if you're a good shot, so you put that effort in, you start that bow, you know, the arrow's going. But who knows, it's 100 yards, if you're really good, I don't know, how many hundred yards? At what point, or do we say, is it still my action? Then the arrow hits somebody. Is that the same thing as me taking a knife and stabbing somebody? Do you say that it's like I'm like invisibly running after that, holding it the whole time? Or do we say, no, it's not that I'm actually doing it, but since I only did one thing, I started it. But since I'm responsible for what happens, and this is a very sophisticated machlokes, which has other ramifications. The bottom line is, if the arrow stops and nothing has happened, the fact that someone else picked it up and did something else with it, certainly your liability would have been over, right? So here too, you, and this, it's in the opposite direction. Here you put in the light bulb. Great, so you turned it on. But then, when they changed generators, for that split second it was off, and then it got turned on again. Not by you, by a non-Jew. That's a very technical problem. Therefore, he concludes, the OU does not subscribe to the light bulb system, though another, see, this is, you know, respectfully disagreeing, though no, a number of other kosher organizations do utilize the light bulb out there. Now, I don't know if there's any others who do. And if they are, it may be more local vadim in different places that rely on Rabbi Heinemann. My impression is of the well-known national or international ones, there aren't others. But, again, that could also easily be verified by a call to the Star K. One thing I'm sure they would tell you is which other organizations do agree with them. I assume that they'd be very happy to share with you. And finally, there's this a lengthier treatment by this Halacha Brura, which, as I say, is basically, it's a younger person writing it, but it's basically entree into Rabbi Belsky or the other another OU perspective. Recently, some, we know who that some is, have suggested that the use of an incandescent light bulb installed in the oven, I got to say that should be an N, by the Mashkiach to serve in place of the splinter thrown into the fire by a Yid. However, leading kosher organizations have rejected this line of reasoning. There are several fundamental differences between the light bulb and the splinter of wood mentioned by the Rama. One difference is that in the Rama's case, the splinter is added to an existing fire. The light bulb, however, is lit by the Yid before the fire in the oven, which will be cooking the food, is ignited. Now, perhaps the answer is, who cares? Maybe that's what Rabbi Hanan would say, so what? But it is true, that is a difference. This light bulb that's turned on well before each successive day the oven gets turned off and turned on, turned off and turned on. So perhaps that's not sufficient. Perhaps the Rama only said, if you already have a raging fire, and then I throw in a splinter, that can contribute. But if I just started a little teeny-weeny fire with the splinter, and then the guy came and put the whole fire on top of me, maybe that wouldn't work. I don't know. That's what he suggests. That's the difference. Additionally, the entire light bulb theory is based on the premise, here, this is a new and original idea that we haven't yet discussed, that the heter of the splinter of the wood is due to the fact that it adds additional heat to the fire, albeit a minuscule amount. That's, in fact, how I explained it to you, right? It's a little bit, but a little bit is a little bit. However, there are another perspective. Many were shown to write that the splinter of wood removes the problem of pasakum, as well as bishalakum, according to Ramo, since the Jew was involved in the preparation of the actual fire that will be baking the food, and is therefore considered as if he lit the entire fire. A light bulb is completely separate from the primary fire, and like the splinter of wood, does not intensify the actual fire. Now this is, he comes at it from a different perspective, but by the end of the paragraph, it's the same argument made by Rabbi Luban. In other words, he says, if it's a question of just contributing a negligible amount, but he says it's not just contributing, it's that by you doing a little bit, we can view it as you doing the whole thing. But that's only possible to make that leap, and it's obviously a huge leap, if you're talking about one integrated process. But if the light bulb is one place, even if it's not that far away, but it's still separate, and the oven is separate, you can't do that. Two more things. Additionally, some Rishonim explained that the heter relying on a splinter of wood is due to the fact that since the Jew performed the act in preparation of the fire, it shows that bread solely baked by goyim is forbidden. Namely, in this case, they hold it's not because you added heat, but it is what we call a heker. It's a sign. The fact that a Jew had to do something, so that is demonstrative as a way of reminding people and oneself that you cannot rely on a non-Jew to just cook exclusively for you. However, he says, or obviously, a light bulb which remains lit for an extended period of time cannot serve as a symbol of the involvement of the Jew in the preparation of the fire. Which, if you accept that premise, I think the conclusion is correct. And as if I have to come, you know, the guy could have just turned on the fire, and I said, no, I'm coming to throw my wood chip in. So each independent time, then you've made that statement. But if I'm turning on a light bulb once and then going Shalom Yisrael, moving to London, and there's a restaurant in Baltimore, so no more Jewish contribution for another year, it's hard to say you're making a statement about Jewish participation. And finally, we conclude, moreover, as mentioned above, many poskim maintain, now we get to your grah. Until now, we weren't talking about any grahs, any chafas adams. It was just the Ramah maybe should allow this. And the answer was, Rabbi Hanan says yes, the others said no. Moreover, he adds, now once we're throwing the fire, pun intended, as mentioned above, many poskim maintain that even the heter of adding a splinter should only be relied upon in extenuating circumstances. And if that's the case, to extend this heter to situations where there's a remote comparison to the use of the splinter of wood and to initially rely on it on a constant basis is incorrect. That is the coup de grace. That's their final stab in Rabbi Heinemann's back. In other words, listen, let's be honest. It's all based on the Ramah. And the Ramah is only bidyeved. So now what is the Star K doing? They're making an extension, which in based on these arguments, is not even a good extension, a tenuous extension, and they're doing it l'chachila. So, from this perspective, that's two wrongs. And two wrongs do not make it right, as we were all taught. So that is the argument. Now, I will just conclude with the following, which I haven't had a chance to follow up on. I had a conversation before I went on vacation, I think it was, with my Rabbi, Rabbi Willig, who has a summer learning program. And I asked him what he was teaching this summer, and sure enough, he's teaching Vishalakum. So I mentioned to him that I only have one shiur left, and this is what I'm getting to, and I'd never, ever once spoken to him. I knew the OU and Rav Shechter and Rav Belsky don't like it. And we were very brief conversation, but he said, oh, I always thought it was good. That much I heard from him clearly. I haven't followed up with him to find out what his understanding of rationale is. Maybe he just reads it behind him straight. I don't know. Maybe he has other arguments. But he said he always assumed that it was a good Hetter. So, again, not that Rav Haim needed any additional help, but it's not Rav Haim alone, perhaps. But it says it's certainly well known that he's the source of the Hetter. And it seems like most don't hold of it, but certainly some do. My feeling is that unless one has a particular Mesorah, a particular Rebbe, who doesn't hold of it, but in general, those of us who live in Baltimore, and generally speaking, except the Vod, which certainly does include certain Chumras, so we have a right to rely on their Kulas also. And if we're consistent and honest about it, then this is a heter of a given restaurant that any of us may, which I don't know yet, but I'm assuming it must be at some. Although your point notwithstanding, maybe if they have mashkichim around, they don't need to. I don't know. But I think if anyone asked me, I would tell them certainly one has the right, certainly in Baltimore. If you're living in Flatbush or something and they want to do this, I don't know, ask a rabbi in Flatbush. But that's a different point. But certainly Baltimore residents have a right to rely on the Vada Kachras of Baltimore. Okay, any questions?